destroyed vehicles in Rafah, southern Gaza. The movement says this act reflects a blatant disregard for humanitarian treaties and the principles of the international law. Hamas also criticized the international community's silence as complicity. The group urged the United Nations and humanitarian organizations, including the International Committee of the Red Cross, to take urgent action to uncover the fate of thousands of missing civilians in Rafah. This came as Israel's military has confirmed firing on ambulances last Sunday in Rafah's Tal al-Sultan neighborhood, labeling them as suspicious vehicles. Israeli latest airstrikes have claimed the lives of at least 14 people and left many others injured in various locations throughout the Gaza Strip. The attacks targeted Gaza City as well as Rafah. 5 people, including women and children, were killed in Khan Yunis. Israeli occupation forces have extended evacuation orders to tens of thousands of residents within the enclave. No food or supplies have entered Gaza for over 3 weeks, making it the longest stretch without aid entering the enclave. Israeli occupation forces resumed their offensive against Gaza on March the 18th, breaking a 2-month ceasefire. Since that time, nearly 950 individuals, mainly women and children, were killed, bringing the death toll since October 2023 to nearly 50,300. Now to give you the latest in Gaza, we are joined by Moti Abu Musabeh in Deir al-Bala. Moti, what do you have to share with us?
Yes, actually, the kind of situation is still grueling for the Palestinian people in the shadow of the ongoing and ceaseless Israeli strikes and attacks are still hitting various parts of Gaza Strip. I'm going to start with the latest update of Gaza's health ministry saying that at least 21 Palestinian civilians have been slaughtered since dawn hours till this moment as a result of the Israeli genocidal air strikes and the artillery shelling targeting the eastern parts of Gaza Strip. And over the past couple of hours, a brutal airstrike hit the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital here, targeting an agricultural land. And the shrapnel of that attack actually landed in the yards of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital here in the central area of Gaza Strip. In the meantime, another attack took place in Gaza City after the Israeli fighter drones attacked a makeshift tent of the Palestinian people in the western part of the city, killing 3 Palestinian women. And in a separate attack, the Israeli warplanes destroyed a residential building in the eastern part of Al-Shaja'iyya neighborhood in Gaza City, killing 2 Palestinian civilians as well. And even when it comes to the northern part of Gaza, the Israeli warplanes continue to decimate multiple areas of that district. And the last attack, and the recent attack actually, took place against a residential building in Beit Lahia City, killing 2 Palestinian civilians. One of them was a baby. And when it comes to the southern parts of Gaza, the last night was bloody for the Palestinian people there, whereas at least 12 Palestinian civilians have been slaughtered after the Israeli occupation forces intensified the artillery shelling against Abassan town in the eastern section of Khan Yunis City. And in the meantime, another massacre took place and committed against the Palestinian people in the western part of the city after the Israeli fighter drones attacked a cart, killing 5 Palestinian civilians. And needless to mention that the humanitarian situation and the current situation is still perilous and catastrophic for the Palestinian people in Rafah City in light of the ongoing military operation that targets the western parts of the city, particularly Tal al-Sultan neighborhood. We are talking about hundreds of the Palestinian people are still releasing more appeals, saying that they are still subjected to the ongoing and non-stop Israeli attacks and the gunfire and the artillery shelling, and they are no longer able to secure any kind of any food items or the drinkable water because the Israeli occupation forces are still beleaguering them. They are still preventing them from having any access to the basic humanitarian essentials and needs. And as you know, in the same context, the civil defense system stated that the fate of 14 members of the civil defense system and the ambulance crews is still unknown. And apparently they were targeted by the Israeli occupation forces. Only one dead body of those Palestinian individuals was found over the past couple of days. So we are talking about more massacres that are still committed against the Palestinian people, while the suffering of the Palestinian people is still aggravating in light of the complete closure of Gaza's crossings, whereas the Israeli occupation forces are still preventing any entry of the humanitarian supplies to the people here for more than 27 consecutive days. So you can imagine how catastrophic the situation is for the Palestinian people, particularly in these days. 2.2 million Palestinian civilians are no longer able to secure any of their basic humanitarian essentials and needs. And this is another materialization of how the Israeli occupation regime is still weaponizing those humanitarian supplies against Palestinian people and using them as another method of war against the vast majority of the Palestinian people in Gaza Strip.
Thank you for that update, Muti. That was Muti Abu Musabir reporting from Deirut Bara, central Gaza. The United States presses ahead with its aggression against Yemen, launching new airstrikes on various areas across the Arab country. Yemeni media say U.S. airstrikes hit Saada, killing one person and wounding four others. The U.S. has reportedly carried out 14 strikes on the outskirts of Saada city. The latest attack comes after the U.S. targeted more than 40 locations across Yemen, including in the capital Sana'a, damaging multiple residential buildings and shops. The U.S. and its allies have escalated their aggression against Yemen after the country resumed its anti-Israel operations over the regime's renewed genocide in Gaza. Washington says it will use overwhelming force until the Ansarullah resistance movement stops its anti-Israel operations. Millions of Iranians have taken to the streets across the country on the International Quds Day to express solidarity with Palestinians and to condemn Israeli atrocities against them. In the capital, Tehran, streets were flooded with demonstrators. Fatima Masumi has more.
Huge crowds rallying in the streets of Tehran to mark International Quds Day. Streets flooded with demonstrators from all backgrounds, waving the flags of Gaza and the Hezbollah resistance movement, holding placards and chanting slogans to show support for Palestinians and denounce Israeli atrocities. Senior officials were also present.
Today at 4 p.m. Venezuela time, our government and people will rally to mark this occasion, condemning the Israeli regime and supporting Palestine. The atrocities occurring can only be described as genocide. Today, in my opinion, is a significant day. The huge turnout of people demonstrates that our citizens understand the situation very well. Clearly, many political dynamics have changed since last year. This turnout reflects that the Islamic Republic of Iran relies on its people.
Quds Day is commemorated on the last Friday of Ramadan. It is a day of international solidarity with the Palestinian people. Just like previous years, Afghan community in Iran also joined other protesters to express their support for Palestinians in Gaza.
We consider Palestine our heart and soul. It is the heart of the Muslim world. Therefore, we urge all officials to take action.
I am here to condemn the Israeli attacks and the egregious atrocities they have committed in Gaza.
The people who participated in the rallies say their presence is a response to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution's call.
I am here in response to our leader's call to come out and send a strong message to the world.
As the son of a martyr, I am here because our leader stated that this year's rallies are even more significant. This huge turnout shows that the resistance is stronger than ever.
As our beloved Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah once said, "We will never abandon Palestine. We are the Shia of Ali ibn Abi Talib, and we will never abandon Palestine, nor the people of Palestine."
The huge turnout in Iran is seen not only as a sign of unity and strength of the Iranian nation, but their steadfast support for the Palestinian resistance.
Iranians have once again resonated voices of solidarity with Palestinians on International Quds Day and strongly condemned their recent renewed Israeli bloodshed, expressing full support for the Palestinian cause. Fatemeh Masumi, Tehran.
In Yarmouk camp, protesters gathered on the last Friday of Ramadan, chanting against the Israeli occupation and in support of Gaza's resilience. The demonstration reflected the deep anger over the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Protesters reaffirmed their solidarity with the Palestinian resistance.
We have taken to the streets to reject surrender and any attempt to crush Palestinian resistance. Our support is unwavering until victory and the full liberation of Palestine. To our people in Gaza, we stand with you, your sacrifices, and your resistance.
Syrians and Palestinians believe the Palestinian cause unites the Arab and Islamic world, bringing together all who stand for justice and resistance.
One day, we will stand on the soil of Palestine. Arabs and Muslims may have their differences, but Al-Quds unites us all. Palestine is a cause of truth and justice, and all free people of the world support it.
Meanwhile, in Umayyad Square, demonstrators condemned Israeli violations in Syria and Palestine, denouncing the occupation's repeated attacks on southern Syria, particularly the recent Qaya massacre.
This demonstration is a message of solidarity with our people in southern Syria, especially after the massacre in Qaya. Israeli attacks on Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine must stop.
Protesters emphasized their rejection of the Israeli occupation and threats. They urged the international community to take a firm stance against Israel's violations of Syrian sovereignty.
Our message to the Israeli enemy is clear. We will resist, just as the heroes of Qaya have proven. And to the international community, you have turned a blind eye to our suffering, and now you ignore the threats against innocent people. At the very least, stop enabling Israel's crimes.
Syrians and Palestinians send a clear message: resistance will not be broken. As Israel escalates its attacks, the people remain steadfast, standing together for Gaza, for Dara, and for the liberation of all occupied lands. Ali Muhammad, Damascus.
The death toll from the Nigerian forces attack on Qods Day protesters in Abuja has risen to 19, with dozens more injured and nearly 200 arrested. Nigerian soldiers opened fire on unarmed protesters just minutes after the rally began. Danjuma Abdullahi reports from Abuja.
The Qods Day rally in Abuja began immediately after Friday prayers as hundreds of demonstrators took to the streets in solidarity with the Palestinian people, particularly those in Gaza who endure severe oppression under the Israeli regime. Less than 10 minutes into the march, Nigerian military forces arrived and launched an assault on the protesters. The intensity of the gunfire disrupted recordings, forcing our camera crew to take cover.
A lot of people have been butchered by these soldiers. I saw so many people on the floor, blood flowing as if we're in Gaza. There is no difference between what happens today. There is no difference between this guard brigade, this so-called army, Nigerian army, and that the IDF of the Israelis. Shooting not on air, shooting on the crowd, using even machine gun, ammo tank, on innocent, unarmed people, majorly female and children.
At the time of filing this report, the Islamic movement was still working to compile a list of those killed. They stated that the task remains difficult as soldiers have been removing the bodies of the martyrs and taking them away. Members of the Islamic movement affirmed their commitment to observing International Quds Day on the last Friday of every Ramadan. They vowed to continue holding protest rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people who remain under oppression by the Israeli regime. They have this message to the Nigerian authorities.
The presidency cannot exempt itself from this brutality, because it is Guard Brigade that opened fire on peaceful protesters. And the Guard Brigade are only answerable to Mr. President. The President Bola Ahmed Tinubu should come out and tell the whole world what happens, what happens, why did you decide to kill people that are showing solidarity with the Palestinians?
Today's attack on the Qods Day peaceful procession in Nigeria is not the first time. Since 2015, security forces in various Nigerian cities, including Abuja, the capital city, have always attacked the Qods Day procession, killing and injuring many demonstrators. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Turning to the Turkish city of Istanbul, where hundreds of thousands have once again gathered at the call of the main opposition to demand the release of Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu. The arrest of President Erdogan's chief political rival has sparked the largest wave of street protests in over a decade. Nationwide demonstrations continue despite government crackdowns, including mass arrests and violent police interventions. Nearly 2,000 protesters, among them at least 10 journalists, have been arrested. İmamoğlu was jailed on corruption charges, widely seen as politically motivated. He was set to stand as the main opposition candidate in Turkey's 2028 presidential election. His detention has drawn sharp international condemnation, with critics calling it a blatant move to stifle dissent. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. We'll see you soon. Take care and bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
the limelight.
The Atlantic journalist Jeffrey Goldberg was added to a Signal group chat with top Trump officials addressing secret war plans. However, Donald Trump's top intelligence officials claim no classified information was shared in the group chat. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. National broadcaster NBC News has covered the story and tells us more. President Donald Trump's top intelligence officials claimed on Tuesday, 25th of March, that they did not share any classified materials in a group text about U.S. military plans that inadvertently included a journalist. National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe both downplayed the mishap at a contentious Senate Intelligence Committee hearing just a day after The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg reported that he had been added to a text thread about U.S. military plans to strike Houthi targets in Yemen. The incident has raised questions about the Trump administration's handling of classified information, as well as its use of the encrypted messaging application Signal and various other electronic communications. In testimony, CIA Director John Ratcliffe acknowledged he was on the text chain, but said it was lawful. He said the Signal app was loaded on his work computer at the CIA when he started the job and claimed it was permitted as a communication tool for work purposes. He did not address whether it was appropriate to share detailed military plans on the app Signal. Tulsi Gabbard, National Intelligence Director, asked by Democrats whether the timing and location of planned military strikes were shared on the chat, replied, "I can attest to the fact that there were not classified or intelligence equities that were included in that chat group at any time." Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of the magazine, The Atlantic, and a veteran national security journalist, reported that the thread on Signal appeared to include Ratcliffe and Gabbard, as well as Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, the U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz. In a Fox News interview on Tuesday night, 25th of March, Mike Waltz said he takes full responsibility for organizing the text group and that a staffer was not to blame for Jeffrey Goldberg's inclusion. Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, said, "I take full responsibility. I built the group. My job is to make sure that everything's coordinated." The military plan discussed in the group chat included precise information about weapons packages, targets, and timing, Jeffrey Goldberg wrote in his article in The Atlantic. He said he would refrain from reporting specific information shared in the chat that could damage America's national security. In an exchange with Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, Tulsi Gabbard says she did not remember discussing specific weapons, targets, and timing. The intelligence officials both testified on Tuesday that Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, was the original classifying authority on the chat. Jeffrey Goldberg, the journalist, reported that one message from a Signal account labeled Pete Hegseth included operational details of forthcoming strikes on Yemen, including information about targets, weapons the U.S. would be deploying, and attack sequencing. CIA Director John Ratcliffe and National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard, responding to a question from Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, said they would cooperate with an audit looking into whether they had used Signal on another messaging platform to discuss classified information. In a statement on Monday, the National Security Council said it was reviewing how an inadvertent number was added to the chain. Tulsi Gabbard would not answer questions about whether she was using her personal phone or her government-issued phone, citing the fact that the signal issue was under review. FBI Director Kash Patel, one of the other witnesses on Tuesday, said he was briefed on the incident on Monday night and did not say whether he planned to open an investigation into the incident. The hearing frequently grew heated. Democrats asked aggressive questions and accused the witnesses of jeopardizing America's national security. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon said he believes Pete Hegseth and Mike Waltz should resign. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, said, "It was mind-boggling to me that all these senior folks were on this line, and nobody even bothered to check whether a journalist or another unauthorized person was in the chat." Continue with NBC News' coverage of this story. In his opening statement, Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, blasted the Trump administration with what he characterized as a cavalier attitude towards classified information, describing it as reckless and sloppy. "The signal fiasco is not a one-off," Senator Warner said. "It is unfortunately a pattern we're seeing too often repeated." Senator Warner added, "The unwillingness of the individuals on this panel who were on the chat to even apologize for acknowledging what a colossal screw-up this is speaks volumes." Senator Warner cited an earlier incident in January when the CIA, complying with a presidential executive order, sent an unclassified email to the Office of Personnel Management with the first names and initialized last names of recently hired employees at the spy agency. Senator Michael Bennet, Democrat of Colorado, grilled CIA Director John Ratcliffe about whether Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, was in Moscow when the group chat conversation occurred. Senator Michael Bennet said, "This sloppiness, this incompetence, this disrespect for our intelligence agencies and the personnel who work for him is entirely unacceptable. It's an embarrassment. You need to do better. You definitely need to do better." Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, the chairman of the committee, did not directly address the signal text chain in his prepared opening remarks. Republican senators largely focused their questions on other issues, including drug cartels and China. Donald Trump, speaking to NBC News by phone on Tuesday, 25th of March, stood by his national security advisor, Mike Waltz. Jeffrey Goldberg reported that he was added to the signal chat after he received a request from a user identified as Waltz. "Michael Waltz has learned a lesson, and he's a good man," Donald Trump emphasized. Speaking from the White House in a lengthy back and forth with reporters on Tuesday, Donald Trump downplayed the events and said, "The chat contained no classified information as I understand it." Trump added, "They were using an app, as I understand it, that a lot of people in government use, a lot of people in the media use." Mike Waltz, who was in the room for a meeting of ambassadors, defended himself amid repeated questions about when Donald Trump learned of the chat and how. Mike Waltz said they planned to look into how journalist Jeffrey Goldberg got added to the chat and whether Signal is secure enough to use for high-level discussions. Fox News Channel has also covered the same story. President Donald Trump is not planning to fire National Security Advisor Mike Waltz in the wake of the Atlantic's reporting of an apparent national security breach according to Fox News Channel. Donald Trump told Fox News he's not getting fired. The president said the incident was a mistake, though there was nothing important in the signal text thread. The president described Mike Waltz as a good guy and added that the attack was a success, referring to the U.S. operation against the Houthis in Yemen. A source close to the president previously told Fox News Channel that Mike Waltz's job is safe and that he's not on the chopping block. Mike Waltz has no plans to resign and stuck to his schedule. On Tuesday, he talked to his Russian counterpart about a Black Sea ceasefire deal and later on Tuesday spoke to President Trump. Mike Waltz is also telling colleagues that he has never met or talked to the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine, Jeffrey Goldberg. Democrats on the House Armed Services Committee are calling for Mike Waltz's ouster over the national security breach. This is outrageous national security breach and heads should roll. We need a full investigation and hearing into this on the House Armed Services Committee as soon as possible, according to Representative Chris DeLuzio, Democrat of Pennsylvania. And also Representative Sarah Jacobs, Democrat of California, said, "We can't chalk this up to a simple mistake. People should be fired for this."
Ocean of Dua.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Thumma salatu wassalamu ala Muhammadin wa alihi al-Tahirin. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you in this edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition, we will inshallah talk about the dua, the reality of supplication, its categories, and we will describe some of its effects. So stay with us. Dear listeners, we were talking about the first constituent of supplication, which was the spiritual attraction, which was one of the most significant assets that God has bestowed upon His servants, and it was the spiritual attraction. We talked about different traditions which this very attraction is emphasized in those traditions, where we read that الدُّعَاء سَلَاحُ الْمُؤْمِنِ, supplication is the believer's weapon, and مَنْ أَعْتَ الدُّعَاء أَعْتَ الْإِجَابَةِ, the one who has given you supplication will respond to it. But we had the question that sometimes supplications are not being responded to, and we're going to get to that question later on. But for the previous program, we talked about this very situation when it happens to a man that in difficult times of his life, in difficult hardships during his life, he does everything and resorts to any means, but he forgets supplication. And of course, it is the only way of salvage supplication. But after suffering a lot of hardships and realizing that no one is able to help him, then he resorts to supplication. We told you, dear listeners, that this, of course, is reckoned as a success. But, dear listeners, this is one of the most important parts of this discussion. And it is this, that the real success is obtained when we resort to supplication at the initial stages of coming across the impassable hurdles, so that God may open up His doors of blessings and abundance before we get despair. So, if we resort to supplication at the very beginning stages of coming across with impassable hurdles, but let me tell you something more than this. If someone always resorts to supplication, even before facing a difficult situation, this is the true meaning of success.
Alhamdulillah, khaliq al-khalq, basit al-rizq, faliq al-asbah, dhil jalal wal-ikram, wal-fadl wal-in'am, alladhi ba'uda fala yura, wa qaruba fashahid al-najwa.
Concerning this issue, reports from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Sheikh Al-Kulayni says, هل تعرفون طول البلاء من قصاره? Do you recognize a long or a short duration of a calamity? قلنا لا. We said no. قال إذا ألهم أحدكم الدعاء عند البلاء فاعلموا أن البلاء قصير. He said, if at the time of disaster it is inspired to one of you to engage in supplication, to practice supplication, you should realize that the disaster will last short. So when a calamity befalls a faithful servant and Allah inspires him to engage in supplication, that calamity, of course, by what has been said in our traditions, will soon disappear. But if one refrains from supplication when he is afflicted with a calamity, the calamity will last longer. So when there is a disaster, we should keep on calling for the Almighty Allah and invoking Allah. So our duty must be for all the time just to practice supplication and dua. Because Hafiz, the Iranian poet, says, Hafiz, it is your duty to engage in supplication, and you should not worry if it is heard or not. So if we think about the issue of supplication carefully, we will understand that the supplication is itself, in its true nature, in its innate nature, a kind of acceptance.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim, He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad, He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean, and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you.
Paradise, thank you Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good, about all the things that we went through, knowing that God stays with us too, it's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Describable, knowing that this
the ocean of dua.
If we think about the issue of supplication, if we think about it deeply in our hearts and minds, we will understand that supplication is a kind of acceptance. Supplication equals to acceptance. But how is that even possible? Because we told you, dear listeners, that sometimes it may happen that a supplication would not be responded to, but of course it is a success even if you do not get the answer and response. If you practice supplication, it is a success. But how? This is the question that should remain to be answered for the other program. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
We've all heard how pesticides are bad and harmful. You need to clean up the produce, the vegetables and the fruits that come from farms that have pesticides used in them because of the residue that is left on the produce. Not to mention the residue in the soil can seep into the waterbeds and pollute the water there, or it could even just be absorbed by the next batch of seeds that will be planted in that same area. It could even destroy the ecosystem in the immediate surrounding of where that pesticide was used, to the point that even birds would not even fly in that same direction anymore, and it would just essentially kill all of the ecosystem and significantly harm it at the very least. So that's only some of the reasons why we consider pesticides to have perhaps more downsides than is worth it. But there is a better alternative: using biopesticides, or in this particular case, a biofungicide, which is a naturally occurring microorganism that is found within the soil. And at this facility right here, at the Nuclear Agricultural School, they found a way to select that particular microorganism among the billions of others within the soil and multiply it in the lab to get it to an amount that it could actually combat the soil-borne diseases that would otherwise need pesticides to get rid of. So that's exactly what we're going to be focusing in this week's episode of Iran Tech. With me, your host, Ali Reza. Stay tuned. Iran's climate naturally gives way for certain types of soil-borne pathogens that thrive on its mostly hot and dry weather. Namely, we have fusarium-based pathogens, which are, again, soil-borne pathogens that cause much wilt and rot in plants. Over here, we have an example. So this is a sample tomato plant that has been wilted as a result of, this is the mold that is caused by the fusarium, which is, again, a type of pathogen, a soil-borne pathogen that thrives on Iran's climate. So how do we combat this? Because pretty much all farmlands in Iran are plagued with this soil-borne pathogen. So there is an antagonist to this pathogen that can also be found within the same soil. It's a type of microorganism named Trichoderma. It's a type of biofungicide. It's a type of fungi that is naturally occurring. But if we're able to select this particular biofungicide from the billions of microorganisms within 1 cubic centimeter of soil and multiply it on a lab level, we can use it as a preventative slash treatment measure against any fusarium-based pathogen that, like I said, plagues every farmland in Iran. And that's really going to be the focus of this week's episode. We're going to talk about how we can select this one particular type of fungi amidst the billions of microorganisms that you can find with just a single cubic centimeter of soil. So stay tuned to find out more about it.
One of the significant activities in the field of nuclear agriculture is the production of biological materials to control soil-borne diseases. Therefore, we are compelled to move towards using mutation by inducing changes in native strains of the country. Good work has been done in this area. For example, the use of mutation methods to improve the characteristics of native Iranian fungi, such as Trichoderma fungi, which control fusarium diseases. The method of mutation or inducing changes to enhance the properties of native Iranian fungi is aimed at providing an alternative to the chemical pesticides commonly used by farmers and agricultural operators. Thus, the best approach is to replace chemical methods with these activities. Work carried out at the Nuclear Agriculture Research Institute includes the irradiation of Trichoderma fungal species in the country, identifying and isolating higher quality strains with significant antagonistic properties against pathogens. Selection, collection, and ultimately their evaluation in greenhouse and field conditions have been conducted at the Institute over the past years. In collaboration with the Ministry of Agriculture, we have sought to obtain permits for the production of biological fungicides, and fortunately, we have succeeded in registering our own Trichoderma mutants for the first time in the country and obtaining production licenses.
Now let's get some terminology out of the way before we go any further. First, we have mutation as a central idea. Mutation can occur randomly, or it could occur as a result of exposure to extreme heat, extreme cold, certain diseases like we experienced with COVID. There were just some random mutations of it. Each mutation could have different properties. It could be more resilient against cold, heat, or disease. Certain mutations of plants, let's say, are just generally more attractive to farmers than others. And what we want to do is to be able to pick that mutation and multiply it to cover an entire farm that is now more resilient to disease, heat, or cold, etc., than the farm that we originally had with the strand that we originally had. So that's the idea of mutation. And then if we take a look back at the idea that we talked about, the soil being a living thing because it houses billions and billions of microorganisms within it, there are certain microorganisms that act as pathogens, which are agents of disease for the plants. And then we have antagonists to that pathogen, which could be pesticides that we create chemically in a lab that have various harmful effects. But then we have biofungicides as one of the types of microorganisms that naturally occur in that like 1 cubic centimeter of soil with billions and billions of microorganisms within it. So the idea is to be able to select and pick that one particular type of biofungicide and multiply it within a lab to use it as the antagonist to that pathogen. And this is really the central idea behind the biofungicide of discussion in this week's episode. So we're picking one particular biofungicide. It's called Trichoderma, and we want to pick it from the billions of microorganisms within the soil and multiply it and use it against certain types of pathogen, for example, Fusarium, which is a type of fungi that creates disease within different types of plants. So with that knowledge in mind, now let's take a closer look at the mutation and the relationship between the antagonist and the pathogen.
Iran's agriculture faces a major challenge, Fusarium diseases. These soil-borne fungi attack crops like wheat, tomatoes, and cucumbers, thriving in Iran's warm and irrigated farmlands. But nature has a defender, Trichoderma. In poorly drained or over-irrigated soil, Fusarium fungi invade roots, blocking water and nutrients. The result? Wilting, stunted growth, and devastating crop loss. Farmers often struggle to control these diseases with chemical fungicides, which can harm the environment and lose effectiveness over time. Trichoderma is a beneficial fungus that fights Fusarium in three powerful ways. 1. It attacks and destroys Fusarium directly, feeding on it like a natural enemy. This reduces the fungal population in the soil over time. 2. It produces antifungal compounds that stop Fusarium from growing. These natural chemicals create an environment where harmful fungi struggle to survive. 3. It strengthens plant roots, making them more resistant to infection. Healthier roots mean stronger plants, better yields, and less dependence on chemical treatments. Applying Trichoderma is easy. It comes in granules mixed into the soil or as a liquid sprayed onto roots. Farmers can integrate it into their existing planting and irrigation system with minimal effort. This eco-friendly solution works even in Iran's dry climate, especially in irrigated fields where Fusarium thrives. Unlike chemical fungicides, Trichoderma is a sustainable option that improves soil health and long-term crop productivity.
One of the challenges we face in ensuring food security is controlling the damage caused by plant diseases. Annually, about 10% of agricultural production is lost due to contamination by pests and plant diseases, removing it from the food supply chain. Until now, chemical control methods have predominantly been used to manage the damage caused by pests and diseases. One eco-friendly approach that helps maintain ecosystem balance while ensuring sustainable disease control is biological control, which involves using a biological agent. An antagonist pathogen is the disease-causing agent that inflicts damage on crops. Microbial relationships are divided into two types, antagonism and symbiosis. Symbiotic organisms coexist, while antagonistic organisms oppose each other. We use an antagonist or natural enemy to control the damage caused by a disease or pathogen in a biocontrol method. On a commercial scale, the use of biocontrol methods often lacks popularity among farmers and producers compared to chemical methods, primarily due to the unavailability of effective biocontrol agents. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, through its Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, utilizes gamma radiation-induced mutation to enhance the antagonistic capabilities of these biocontrol agents. One well-known antagonist is the Trichoderma fungus. Trichoderma can naturally control a wide range of plant pathogens and diseases. However, to effectively use Trichoderma in managing plant disease damage, we need strains with high efficiency. Here, you can see an image of spores from a native strain of Ganoderma fungus isolated from soils in our country. When Trichoderma spores are exposed to gamma radiation, they may undergo genetic changes. Those genetic changes that increase the antagonistic power of Trichoderma are identified and isolated as desirable mutations by experts in microbiology laboratories. After exposing Trichoderma spores to gamma radiation, the DNA of the spores may undergo mutations under various scenarios. These scenarios could include nucleotide changes, such as inversion, translocation, or substitution. Each of these mutations can lead to new phenotypes and genotypes in the genetics of Trichoderma. To screen or select mutant strains resulting from gamma radiation, we utilize genetic markers based on the amplification of specific genomic regions or protein markers.
In the past year and a half that this lab has been working on producing this biofungicide, it has managed to produce roughly 3.5 tons of effective agent, because as you know, any type of drug has an effective agent and a lot of carrier. In this case, the carrier makes up the vast majority of the weight, which has amounted to 35 tons of pesticides not being imported into the country, because, you know, the most common, most accessible way of dealing with this fusarium-based pathogens has been to just use pesticide, which we've already talked about just how many negative effects it can have on the soil, the environment as a whole, and on the farmers who are using these pesticides. So it has prevented the use of 35 tons of pesticide, and it has been able to do that with the same amount of effectiveness as a pesticide. So with the reduced cost of making it, there's really no reason to go back to using pesticides. So hopefully they keep doing what they're doing and be able to cover more ground when it comes to soil-borne diseases, if there is any left. And with that said, I think that's going to be it for this week's episode of Iran Tech. I'll see you guys next week.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Hamas calls for international investigations into Israel's targeting of medical teams in Gaza as the regime admits firing on ambulances in the Palestinian territory. The United States conducts new deadly airstrikes on several areas in Yemen, including the capital Sana'a. And the death toll from the Nigerian forces attack on Quds Day protesters in Abuja has risen to 19, with dozens more injured. Welcome to the program. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has strongly condemned the targeting of medical